Eight-man crew is the most difficult team sport in the world. The average human body is just not meant for such things. It's just not capable of such things. But average is not going to get a seat on my boat. So good luck.
That's the scene in a movie called The Boys in the Boat, where the coach of the University of Washington's rowing team lets his boys in the boat know just what they're in for. That coach's team went on to win the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, achieving an inspirational feat in the run-up to World War II. That feat was celebrated a decade ago in an award-winning book, and now the book has been turned into a big-budget Hollywood movie. Is eight-man crew still the most difficult team sport in the world? Or have advances in technology and training helped the boys in the boat up their game? Greetings, Earthlings. I'm Alan Boyle, your host for the Fiction Science Podcast, coming to you from the place where science intersects with fiction and popular culture. Today, we're talking with John Titus, the president of Seattle's Pocock Racing Shells, about how the sport of rowing has changed since the year Adolf Hitler hosted the Olympics. The Boys in the Boat is a story that blends sports drama with a slice of history that's particularly well known in the Pacific Northwest. It's about working-class boys who joined the University of Washington's rowing team in part to escape the hardships of the Depression and end up winning the gold medal at the 1936 Olympics in Nazi Germany with Adolf Hitler in the stands. One of the most interesting characters in the movie is hardly a boy. He's George Pocock, the British-born boat builder who created the craft in which the gold was gained. In the movie, he plays a role that's similar to Yoda in the Star Wars movies. In real life, Pocock led the Seattle company he founded until his death in 1976. Today, the president of Pocock Racing Shells is John Titus, who took over the helm of the company from his father, Bill Titus, 6 years ago. The Titus family is carrying on the traditions that were created by George Pocock and his son, Stan Pocock, but they're also adapting those traditions to new technologies ranging from carbon composite manufacturing to computer modeling. To celebrate the debut of the Boys in the Boat movie, I talked with John Titus about the current state of boat building technology. My first question, how much has that technology changed over the past 87 years?
A lot has changed. The basics, obviously, those boats were all wooden. They had some metal parts, both alloy and steel, but for the most part, the boat itself was wood. Now, the boats have no wood. These boats are all built out of advanced composites, mainly carbon fiber, which as a material is, for its weight, the strongest material available. And when I say available, that means available to somebody like us, a sporting goods manufacturer. Aerospace might have access to some materials that we may not, but otherwise, the biggest difference is really the materials, and it's carbon fiber versus wood.
Mm-hmm. And what stayed the same? Are there some elements of the design that have survived from those days?
Yes. The boats they're still long and skinny. They're very similar in length, although there's been a lot of work done on, you know, when considering drag and moving an object like a big crew of nine men or women through a medium such as water. There's been a lot of work on the drag science. And so the boats are still long, but they're not as long as they were back in the 1930s. But we're roughly talking about a 67-foot long boat back then, 66 feet, depending on the size of the crew, to roughly 59 to 57 feet long now. But otherwise, they look very similar. Still long and skinny, still very, very narrow, still very tippy, still in cross-section a similar shape. Otherwise, the improvements would be in adjustability and what we call rigging in the sport, which is ways to modify the gearing per each athlete so that their load might be different than some of their teammates, in order to suit a different body style, body type, that kind of thing. Much more high-end materials, much more high-end parts. And another main difference would be, if you look at the Husky Clipper, which was the boat that was raced in Germany, that boat had what we call outriggers, which is what holds the oarlock out in space from the center line of the boat, those would have been attached to the side of the boat, made from stainless steel or alloy, aluminum. Now they're what we call wing riggers, and they're all composite, pretty much. They're carbon fiber.
Do you feel as if the design of racing shells has reached its peak? Is there anything else that can be done to optimize the design?
Well, by rule, we can't do much. There are very few rules as far as the boats are concerned, but the main rule is that we cannot modify the surface in a way that is not adaptable to anybody that would have access to a boat and or any other country, that sort of thing. We can't have a sliding rigger, which was tried for a little bit. The rigger has to be fixed, and that was a distinct advantage, so they took that away. And then otherwise, the only real rule is a weight. We have a minimum weight the boats are supposed to be, and so we build to that. And so we're constantly battling the boat's weight versus its stiffness versus its price. You pick two of those. If you want a stiff boat that's light, it's going to be expensive. If you want a very stiff boat that's durable, it might be a little heavy, and so on.
How much does a racing shell go for nowadays?
Our top-of-the-line boat is just over $60,000.
I imagine that's a little more expensive than it was back in the days of the boys in the boat.
Yeah, well, the story goes that back then, George would give them away anyway. He rarely charged full freight, and many times, apparently, he gave them away. So, yes, things are different now.
You mentioned drag science. That's interesting. How do you test how a boat performs? I think in aerospace, you've got a wind tunnel, but do you have a water tunnel for racing shells?
Well, interesting question and fascinating science, honestly. There is the equivalent of a wind tunnel for boats. It's called a tow tank. And there are a handful of them around the country, ones at the Naval Academy. And what that is a designer will build a scale model of the form of the hull that they want to drag through the water. They load it up with sensors. The tow tank is then a pool of moving water that drags this this form through that water, and it measures flow over the course of the surface area of that hull. And that's been those have been around for a long time, and there's been a lot of money spent on similar forms for the industries that make a lot of money, freighters, cruise ships, those kind of things. Those people are always trying to find a more drag efficient hull shape because that saves money on fuel, all the above. The problem with rowing boats, though, is that the motion of the boat is not constant. Rowing shells, by definition, either stop or go backwards every time the crew oscillates, every time the crew takes a stroke. And that has major problems with the flow of the boat as far as laminar flow, stuck to the side, the water stuck to the side of the boat. It loses contact every stroke. And so racing shells are an absolutely different beast than any other boat that goes through the water. And and it's proven because, oftentimes, there's been a lot of work on America's Cup sailboats or high-end sailboats, racing boats over the years, even though those sailboats fly now. They're not even boats, really, but the work that's been done on those boats by very famous nautical designers, and they always say, well, racing shells must be simple. I'll take a turn at one of those. And various builders will hire one on. And more often than not, that boat's a real dog, just like some of the America's Cup boats are. America's Cup boats aren't all fast. Sometimes they one comes out that's just not as fast in certain wind conditions as the others.
Now, in aerospace, there's a lot of reliance on computational fluid dynamics to design a plane virtually before you actually build it. And in every profession, there's a lot of talk about how artificial intelligence might transform any sort of field. Do you find that there is an impact of computational technology on boat building?
Absolutely. Because the normal testing protocols that we have available are frankly so inconsistent, going back to the discussion on the tow tank, we have to rely on computers. And it's funny. So whenever we design a new shell, a new shape for a shell, a lot of it's based on intuition. And and what we've proven to ourselves from previous iterations of hull shapes. Because when we go and put certain shapes into various computer modeling applications, sometimes that shape looks promising in one modeling situation, and then another program, it might look slow. And so, again, there's a lot of art that goes into this. We have to interpret what we're reading. And there is no, it's just not cut and dried. There's a lot of interpretation and intuition and time. It's that simple. AI, I'm afraid to go there. I haven't looked into that one yet, but I'm sure it's coming.
Uh-huh. Are there lessons that people say who are designing planes or cars can learn from the work that you and other people have done with boats?
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, you know, the laws of physics, just, you know, coming from the apple falling out of the tree. I mean, it's just those are rules that cannot be argued with. And so the boats have a lot of design parameters involved in them from, you know, ideas like that, but they just can't change that much. If we really tried to make a boat, for instance, people always say, well, how come we can't make a rowing shell foil? Well, to make a rowing shell foil, it would change the sport of rowing as far as what the athletes had to do to keep the boat up on step, first of all, or up on a foil. The equipment would have to change. These are drastic, drastic things that would have to change where it's just not realistic. And this is not just me saying this. This is known amongst all the builders. Like, that ain't going to happen. Okay, well, how about a catamaran? How about we make a tunnel hull? Well, these are full displacement boats. They don't create much lift. They don't plane. Okay. These are, again, these boats have the full submersion of the hull based upon the payload in that hull, which is the definition of a full displacement boat. And yes, the rowing action tends to lift the boat a little bit out of the water, but it's not a function of the hull. It's a function of the crew within the hull. And so physics doesn't lie, and there's no getting around that. I mean, these boats are what they are.
Mm-hmm. You may be biased, but do you think that there have been bigger changes over the past few decades in boat building or in athlete training when it comes to rowing? What are the big factors in terms of rowing performance?
Well, I am biased, obviously, but I also was a rower, so you know, and trained at a pretty high level, so I understand both well. A lot of listen. As stark as the difference between wood and carbon fiber might be, the training volume that the crews do now compared to what the boys did in 36, that's actually a bigger quantum leap, if you will, from wood to carbon fiber. The amount of training that goes in, the diets, the size of these guys. When you watch the movie, you know, the size of the actors that are acting, these are not rowers. These are actors first that learned how to row well enough to film a movie. And these guys are not ready to go to a national championship. Trust me. The size of those athletes that were the actors were probably very similar to what the crew looked like back in 36. You know, a handful of guys that were 6 foot, maybe one or two that were 6'2 or 6'3. I can't remember how tall somebody like Joe Rance was, but I believe he was the tallest member of the crew. But nowadays, if you go watch Washington row now, that's a boatload. That's eight guys that are, they probably average 6'5", 6'6". And most collegiate crews these days average a collegiate men's varsity crew. I would bet averages 6'2 to 6'3". And most female crews, I'm going to say they average 5'9", 5'10", maybe 5'11" for women. Mm-hmm. And these are, the bodies are bigger. The people that are finding rowing are, the bodies are more tailored to good rowing. And then the training they do, these guys, these athletes are just stronger. They're tougher. I'm not sure they're tougher. They're definitely stronger. They're fitter. I know that because they spend so much more time training than they would have previously.
Well, I was going to ask whether today's rowers could beat the boys in the boat, but I have a feeling I already know what the answer is going to be. But would it be even close?
Well, you know what? I don't know. The world record now for a men's crew over 2,000 meters, which is the Olympic distance, I think is low 5:20s, 5 minutes, 20 seconds or so to row basically a mile and a quarter. The race course in Germany was 2,000 meters as well. And I probably should know this. I don't know how fast that crew raced, but I would venture a guess they were probably in the low sixes, you know, 615, maybe 620, I think. But there was also that day was pretty rough. It was windy. So hard to really say. If I had to bet, I would say that, yes, a modern crew would obliterate that crew from back then. But also, you know, these are rowboats that are powered by human bodies. I mean, a minute is a long time in a rowboat. Okay, so it might not look like a ton. 1 minute is a long time when it comes to 2,000 meters in rowing. Yes, I think that there's a stark advantage to what we're doing now compared to back then.
How has the movie and the process of filming this book, turning it into a big screen production, how has that been received in the community of boat builders and rowers?
Well, for rowers, it's really added a lot of excitement. You know, there's numerous movies that have come out over the years about rowing or have had rowing in them. But it's, for the most part, it's a pretty, you know, not misunderstood, but, you know, a lot of people kind of know of rowing, but don't really know a lot about it unless they've got somebody actively involved, whether it's a child or a relative or a friend. But the community itself has been very excited about this because this is the first time it's been a full-blown, big budget Hollywood production. Usually they're straight to VHS style movies. Yeah, but there's been ones. I mean, Nicolas Cage was in one called The Boy in Blue about a guy named Ned Hanlon, a Canadian rower. That was back in the 70s, I think. And that was probably a big budget movie back then, but nothing like this. As far as boat builders are concerned, anything that draws attention to the sport is fun. People ask all the time, though. They say, hey, this movie must have really boosted sales. And or the book must have really boosted sales. And I giggle and say, no, it doesn't. It hasn't boosted anything. I mean, we've sold some T-shirts, maybe, but sold boats? No, hasn't happened.
You mentioned the Nicolas Cage movie. Are there any other works that you would recommend, books besides The Boys in the Boat, that can kind of provide a window into that world?
Movies? No, I would not recommend any rowing movies. they're just not accurate, not good. Books, absolutely. There's a handful of books that are written by you know, a David Halberstam book called The Amateurs was about a crew, ultimately about, you know, there's always been this romanticized infatuation with British rowing for Americans. And so, you know, the famous Oxford-Cambridge boat race, which is a big deal every spring around Easter. For years, Americans have joined those crews. They go over to Oxford and do a quick tour through the school for a year and get another master's in economics or something like that and get to row with the crew and race. So a man named David Halberstam, he wrote a book called The Amateurs, which was about Americans going and racing in the blue boats. That was a great book. The other great rowing book that's one of my favorites was one called it was called Assault on Lake Casitas, and that was about specifically a local to Seattle man named Paul Enquist and his doubles partner Brad Lewis, who came out of the dark to win the Olympic double in 1984, and that book is a textbook on how to win a gold medal in rowing is what that is. Otherwise. There's the memoirs of both Stan Pocock and George Pocock are neat books. And then movies. The only one I can really recommend is one that you can find on YouTube that's called Symphony of Motion, made back in the early 70s, which I like that one because that stars my dad. My dad's in that one.
Wow. So,
yeah, but it's hardly a Hollywood production, but a neat movie. More of like one of the ones that we would have seen, you know, on a rainy day in third grade, they would have pulled out the audio visual cart and put that one through. That's what we all would have watched that.
Well, you haven't seen the movie yet, but is there something in particular that you're going to be watching for when you see it?
Well, I've seen all the equipment that was produced for it, in some cases up close and otherwise in photos. I guess what I'm looking for really is, you know, just to see how good a crew from somebody that appreciates, you know, really good rowing. I'd like to see how good a group of actors can get at rowing over the course of 5 or 6 months preparing for a role. I'd probably like to see that. Otherwise, you know, I've heard it multiple times from Mr. Clooney himself and others, but it's really hard to take all the details of that book, which made everybody love it so much, and put it in a 2-hour movie. There's going to be a lot of stuff left out that was, you know, and the book was a lovely book, and I've read it multiple times. I've given it to everybody I know. They've read it. And like most people, it was really appreciated. I'm always weary of when movies come out. And so I hope this is more than just a Rudy style effort, but honestly, I'm not holding my breath.
Well, it's clear you're no amateur. I thank you so much, John, for being part of the podcast, and we'll look forward to seeing the movie myself. Thanks.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thanks to John Titus and to Hannah Stabingas at We Communications for setting up the interview. For more about The Boys in the Boat, and about Pocock Racing Shells, including links to movie reviews, a PBS documentary about the 1936 Olympic rowing team, and the YouTube movie that John mentioned, check out my blog item at cosmiclog.com. Thanks to James Emley for performing the Fiction Science theme music, composed by yours truly. Please subscribe to our Fiction Science podcast, and feel free to give us a stellar rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your favorite podcast channel happens to be. And so, until next time, this is Alan Boyle advising you to watch the skies.